So thank you very much, David, again, for agreeing to sit with us. As we've discussed before, the purpose of this interview is mostly to talk about the spin glass and replica symmetry breaking period from 1975 to 1995. But to get to that, we were going to go a bit into the background that led to that period.
Yep.
So you sent us some notes about your youth and background in particular that helps us situate your upbringing in the UK. But in those notes, you actually don't mention anything about physics. Where does your interest in physics come from, and what led you to pursue a PhD in physics eventually, ultimately?
Well, I think maybe from childhood, I was always inclined towards mathematics. There's going to be some mathematical subject. At school, in my secondary school, I actually had to specialize in the what we call a sixth form in the math, some science subjects, which were for me mathematics, physics, and chemistry. And I had outstanding teachers, and I liked those things. I guess I was probably inclining towards mathematics or maybe chemistry, but then I decided that really, no, it was going to be physics. I don't know if I was to answer that now. I mean, think about what I would do now. It would be physics, because that's what I feel interested in. And there's a way of thinking that physicists have. But whether that's a consequence for me of the way I was brought up, of the choices I made, or whether it's the reason that I made the choices, I'm not sure. But that's why I think I mentioned to you that I think of myself as a theoretical physicist rather than a mathematical physicist. I'm interested in knowing how things work, and particularly also in sort of many body types of things, so their interactions. I suppose it could have been chemistry. My maths teacher did send me to some place to try out mathematics, but it was some actuarial outfit, and I decided that was going to be goddamn boring, and that probably drove me further towards physics. But I don't know. I mean, in my school, I think I mentioned to you, I did pretty well in the schools, but in my secondary school, there were three of us who did one, two, three. We have 5 years, and then you go into sixth form. And in the third form of this stage, we were one, two, three, and they decided to move us all up to the fifth group, missing out the fourth. And there we saw a challenge, and we came one, two, three in that year as well. And I think that there's been challenges have been things that have intrigued me. And I think now the way I view it is that there are a huge number of challenges in what I call condensed matter physics, which I view in a rather broad sense. But I don't know. I used to like making things and so on. I can't really give a good answer, except that I'm glad that it's what I did.
Good. And then throughout your undergraduate degrees, I mean, you decided to carry on with postgraduate studies, right? To pursue a
Yes,
PhD.
yes.
What How did that come about, and how did you choose the topic?
Well, firstly, I think because I was always doing very well at school and then at university too, it was natural to keep going on. So I didn't really seriously think about going out into industry, because I still seemed to be doing well. Well, actually, I mean, I think I thought about it even earlier, because when I was applying for as an undergraduate, I was at the system in Britain then was that you did 2 years in this sixth form, but if you wanted to go to Oxford or Cambridge, you had to do a third year. No boy in my school had ever been successful in that third year effort, a few that did it. So I decided that I wouldn't do that. I'd rather take that extra year towards a future PhD at university. So I was already thinking about it at that stage. I would ordinarily have moved to another university, because I believe that that's the right best thing to do. It just so happens that at that time I thought the best place to be in England would have been with Rudolf Piles, who was at that time in Birmingham, had a very strong group, but he was going to move to Oxford, but he was going to move to Oxford in what would be the middle of my PhD. And so it meant that I'd be screwing up if I went to either Birmingham or Oxford. And so I decided that I would stay in Manchester. I was keen to work with Sam Edwards, but in fact, who had been my tutor and also one of my lecturers. But in fact, I was allocated to work with somebody else, with this guy, Arvid Hertzenberg. And so we worked on a different thing in that first year. That's when I did my theoretical chemistry, if you like, when I involved in many body theory of small molecules, using ideas from and techniques from nuclear physics. I mean, not of particle physics, but nuclear physics. There were no books at that time in any condensed matter physics and stuff. So we used, anyway, that's what I did for that 1 year, but it wasn't really what I wanted specifically to do. I mean, I wanted to work with Sam. So I changed in the second year of my doctorate. Well,
so sorry, you said you were assigned, so you didn't get to choose who was your PhD advisor, or is this?
No, I guess it depends on how much you push, but no, I think at that stage you were sort of assigned, and I kind of assumed that I would be assigned. I mean, maybe I'd given some indication that I would want to work with Sam. I can't honestly remember now, but it didn't happen. And maybe they thought it was good for me to do something different. And I don't know the reasons, really. But yeah, there was a certain element of assignment.
I see.
But then the going on to Sam was by choice. I mean, I persuaded him to take me on at that point.
So you petitioned the change group, and that worked.
There's no group. There was no group. I petitioned. I spoke to Sam, and he agreed, and maybe also to Arvid, who was my supervisor. We didn't have a committee, if that's what you mean by the change group.
Okay.
But at least not that I was aware of. And I did serve for a little while on the faculty there, but I don't remember one then either.
So after your time at your PhD, you moved actually to a group that also has an intricate connection with chemistry, right? The group of Walter Cohn at La Jolla.
Yes.
I mean, and I couldn't help but notice that you did this only a couple of years after he formulated density functional theory. Was that?
Yeah, I was more or less doing it at the same time. It was about, yes, a year or year and a half, maybe after that. There were two of us who worked with Walter as postdocs. The other was Norton Lang. Norton continued on with the density functional things, and he did that, for a lot of his life after that. So it was going on there. I was perfectly well aware of it, but that's not what I worked on.
So how did you get to know Walter? How did you make the choice to go work with him then?
Okay, well, I think this is the way that often happens, that, you know, I consulted my advisors in Manchester about good places to go to. I knew some from the literature, although there was no internet or no these other things. And Sam recommended, among other people, there was Elliot Lieb at that time Northwestern, Vic Emery in Long Island, and Walter Cohn. All three of them offered me places, but in fact, it was Vic Emery, when I spoke to him about it, said go to California, and I haven't regretted that. And it was a great place. I mean, not only was it just after Walter did this kind of work and also started the excitonic insulator business in that burst, it was very close to the beginning of that university. And that university, of course, was created very specially as a reaction to the Americans, to the Russians sending up the Sputnik. They had some remarkable people. I mean, I think that there were 5 or 6 or maybe 7 Nobel laureates on my corridor in the when physics went across to chemistry. But I didn't know at that time that I was working with a future Nobel laureate. But I would say that Walter considered himself as a physicist, although he did get the Nobel Prize in chemistry.
Yes, I know. And then you were recruited back from that group to Imperial. In the group, well, I mean, in the department led by Brian Coles, if I understand.
Well, he was running the solid state physics group there. There had been a small theory group which was Seb Doniak and Martin Zuckerman. Martin was leaving and I was offered his job. But before I could go there, Seb decided to take a job at Stanford. And so I was left with nothing and had to build that that thing back up again. You know, it was, I'd been in Manchester all the time. I'd been there as an undergraduate. I'd been there as a graduate student. I'd been there as a faculty member. It would have been very easy for me to go back there. It was a good university. I mean, it had a very good record. It has umpteen Nobel Prizes of its own and so on. But I thought that I needed a challenge. And I thought that Imperial was going to be such a challenge. And so I went there. I did discover it was a lot more expensive to live there than it was in Manchester and other things like that. But I went there for the challenge and I thought it can't really fail. And I was only in my mid-20s. So,
And how was it to be then the sole theorist in a... You're surrounded by a premier experimental condensed matter group, right? So
yes, yes. When I went there, I had two people who were already engaged that I was going with. It was a Pakistani graduate student and a visitor from Vassa. So both not from particularly fancy places. There was some theoretical condensed matter physics going on in the mathematics department, a group led by Peter Wohlfarth and David Edwards. They were interested in itinerant magnetism and Hubbard models and these sorts of things. And there was an excellent theoretical physics group. So there I was in the solid state area, but there was an outstanding theoretical particle physics group with Matthews and Salam, among other people. So, there were some very good theorists, but they just weren't in my immediate group. But it was a friendly place, and I got to know all these other people too. And there were some good theorists in some other different areas. But, I mean, in Manchester, I'd been in a theoretical physics subdepartment. Here in Oxford, you've got a theoretical physics subdepartment, but in Imperial, it was a solid state department subdepartment.
Okay, so did you get to interact? So how much were the problems you're interested in motivated by the group in which you were embedded at Imperial, or was it pretty disconnected overall?
Well, you'll have seen that I was going from different subject to one subject to another. That was part of my general belief that one should learn a number of different things that you can then draw on later and put together things that may not be available to people who've been in all one area at a time. So, yes, I was influenced by the kind of things that were being done by the experimentalists in the thing. And this different kind of magnetism. As I say, at the time when I was in UCSD, there was magnetism work, but it was mainly of a Kondo type of thing, of single impurities. And times were at that point starting to become conscious to people about interacting impurities at finite concentrations rather than single very low concentrations. And one of the most important experimental groups for that was Coles's one. And so he and I thought different ways, but he stimulated me to think about things. I mean, I like to get stimuli and then go and think about them myself rather than to follow the existing tracks. So that had a good influence. And then, as I said, in the mathematics department, there were these people who were looking at itinerant magnets, and that was going to. I was kind of in between, having earlier worked on systems with good moments, like the rare earth metals, and then these other people working on itinerant systems where the magnets are carried by the electrons, and then people like in Coles's group, where you have metals that are, you know, sometimes one form and sometimes another. So all these things kind of influenced the way that I was thinking, but usually it was all the way through my career, I've had things happen around me and they spur me into thinking about something and then it goes.
So in that context, right, Coles is often credited for having discovered spin glasses, or at least having named them.
Yes.
So were these materials discussed during your first years at Imperial? Were you aware of?
Oh, yes. I mean, they were, I knew about them, but and also about other types of transition metal alloys and actinides, what do you call them, lanthanides, all sorts of these things, all these different metallic things we thought about. But prior to the experimental work of Canella and Midosh, these alloys, which were called Spinglasses, they showed susceptibilities that had a rounded peak. Okay, the rounded peak. It's a kind of glassiness. It's just slowing down, was the thought. There were it was clear that there were other things going on which were novel and new in some way, like, for example, that people, it was known that these things must have had some sort of freezing of the magnetic moments over long, the localized moments, over longish periods of time. You could tell that by looking at nuclear experiments where you measure the nuclear hyperfine field. There's a coupling called AI.S between the nuclear and the electron spin, which incidentally I knew about from my other earlier work on the rare earth metals. So if the spins freeze, then it provide a local moment. So if you've got a local probe like a nuclear spin, such as you get in a Mossbauer effect, then it tells you that the localized moment is not changing over the time that it takes for something to happen electronically on the nuclear spin. So that was known. So there must be freezing or getting very slow somehow. It was also known that they were not periodic magnets. They didn't show any overall magnetization. They didn't show up any new peaks and neutron scattering. I was exposed to all of this stuff and knew about it, but I wasn't necessarily, you know, doing a lot with it myself at that point. But then Canella was known to, Midosh was known to us because he'd been a postdoc in Coles's group. But we heard, you know, he did these experiments on gold iron, and he decided to do them in a very, very low field. And in a very low field, this thing that was rounded became sharp. You could see he's got results in there with various very, very small fields. It's rounded, rounded, goes long down in field, and you start to see the thing becoming a cusp. A cusp is a signal to a theorist of a phase transition. It's not just some slowing down pissy stuff. It's a phase transition, or perhaps it's a phase transition. And so that was a eureka moment for people. We still didn't know how to solve it. My colleague at that time, when I went there, I was able to employ a new lecturer, and that was Nicolas Rivier. And he was interested in this and came out with a kind of mean field theory for it, which I don't know if it was right, but it was one of the things that finally stimulated Anderson to tell Edwards that these guys have got this theory, we think it's wrong, let's have a think about it again. So I was exposed to these various things, but then I think my first encounter with spin glass, first paper I ever wrote on spin glasses, was on what would be now a kind of unusual thing. It was because Coles was doing experiments also on not only on metals where the magnetic element had a good moment, even in isolation, which is what you have in the standard spin glasses, but also ones where the impurity was something which would normally, in pure system, would be an itinerant magnet, but which in these systems, in an isolated one, would not show a moment, only show fluctuations. And there was a fashion at that time, particularly, for example, among my colleagues in the mathematics department elsewhere in the world, that looking at disordered systems, one would use a kind of averaging thing. It's called the coherent potential approximation or uniform enhancement or whatever. And basically, you replace the alloy by an average system, which was then effectively pure, but had different parameters. And I thought, that's boring. But also at the same time, there was an interest going on in localization. Now, Neville Mott was a regular visitor to our group at Imperial, and so from time to time was Phil Anderson. And so I was conscious of the the idea that you could have localization, particularly the Anderson localization, was intriguing me because, although I was talking about both, that if you have statistical clustering of where the bits are, then you can form moments. This made me then try to put the two things together that the Coles had already got these experiments on things like rhodium cobalt. Cobalt in rhodium in isolation does not have a moment. If you go to larger concentrations, then it does have a moment and it shows this spin glass-like behavior. So where does it come from? And the answer, in my view, is that the cobalts are distributed randomly. But as we know, statistically, there will be regions where there are more and regions where there are less. Those fluctuating regions where there are more kind of nucleate pieces of cobalt together. So in a way, it looks like a piece of cobalt rather than just an atom of cobalt and can form a moment. And I tried to think about this in the context of one of these alloys and argued that you should have these clusters, and that the clusters will then, just because these are metallic systems with oscillating interactions, probably have spin glasses too. But I didn't know the theory of how you got the spin glasses to do it, but I could do the thing about the clustering. It was also related in some way to some other, the way I thought about it was in relation to some things I'd thought about years back when I was doing my PhD on these functional integral things. I could, because often one was interested in what was happening to collective excitations, and I knew how you could change from the electron variables to, say, the density variables or other things. And in this case, these became the magnetic densities and so on and so on and so on. And that was the first thing I did. But then I still hadn't solved the spin glass problem, but it indicated why these particular things might be spin glasses and need a certain concentration to become spin glasses. But Edwards, he'd moved from Manchester to Cambridge, but he was also head of our research council. So this was called the Science Research Council. It was Britain's analog of the National Science Foundation, covering all the sciences, and he was its head. And so I had to go to meetings in London quite often to run this outfit. But he wanted people to talk to. And so there were two things that he did. One was when he'd go back to Cambridge at the weekend and talk to Phil Anderson. And they, as you've probably read in the things that we've both written, Phil suggested this to him as a problem because Sam wanted a good problem to think about on the train. And so it went on. But then he also wanted other people to talk to about it. And he was in London and I was in London and we knew one another and we got on well, and we thought in similar fashions. And so he talked to me. And that's how I learned about it. And then, the paper, if you look at it, when I looked at it, it was very difficult to read. It was all kinds of different things on every page. And so I had one thought, which was to try to see,
before we dive in there, I just want to make sure we don't skip over anything. So you said you would come to you at Imperial. So Sam would come to visit you at Imperial. You'd meet in town, or you would go to his office. What was
I don't remember precisely. He would often come to my office, but when I say often, I don't mean every week. I mean every now and then. But he had a very, very bright graduate student in Cambridge who he wanted to see a little more frequently than he would be able to do ordinarily. And so he had this guy come and base with me. So I was his kind of nominal supervisor at Imperial, but Sam was his real supervisor. And so they would get together. I think that in those cases, mostly, his name is Mark Warner. He's doing very well, but he would go to State House or whatever and talk to Sam there. But I went a couple of times. I suppose what I really mean is that every now and then, if Sam wanted to try out something on somebody else, then he would come and see me. And he had this new idea, and it was sufficiently different from anything other people were doing that I can't remember exactly how it happened, but I do seem to recall that he told me about it in front of the blackboard in my office or another office nearby. I think I went to his place too, but that was kind of, I mean, I think it was an escape from this place. He was quite happy to escape from his administrative duties to somewhere that was more scientifically real.
So the first paper that I could find that you wrote about, or that was related to the Edwards Anderson paper, is a paper with maybe a postdoc of yours, Byron Southern.
Byron,
and it came out in the same issue actually as the EA paper.
When Sam told me about this stuff, it set me thinking kind of immediately. But remember, Sam's paper was based on what is the simplest possible thing he could think of just on the train journey to look at. So he thought, well, it's really the variation between positive and negative exchange interactions that's the important thing. So he chose to use a Gaussian distributed PoJ. Now, I haven't talked to him about why he did that, but my guess from what I do know about him is that he did it because, first of all, he didn't want any other questions of, you know, possibly it's going to be a ferromagnet, or possibly it's going to be a straight anti-ferromagnet. It couldn't be. If you took a symmetric distribution, it had to be something new. And secondly, we both knew that Gaussians were good things to work with. And so that's, I think, why he did that. But remember, I was in an experimental, surrounded by this experimental group who were looking at real alloys. Okay, so one aspect of real alloys is the different interactions, but that's not the important one. One of the features that they would get was, say you took something like copper manganese or gold iron, it's a spin glass at certain concentrations, but it becomes a ferromagnet at other concentrations. It depends upon the balance. So what that means is it clearly depends upon the balance between the variance of the interaction, effective interactions, and the mean. And so if I was going to come anywhere close to explaining this transition to my experimental colleagues, we had to have a possibility of a mean that wasn't zero as well. And so that was the first thing that Byron and I looked at. We did then also play with other kinds of hand-waving things, which, kind of mean field theories without any definite proof. But what I wanted to do really, what I did do, was to find something for which I could apply a kind of test of all the other approximations he was making by looking at a problem which should be exactly soluble. And I had enough background to know what those might be. And so we tried it, and I went through all the motions. I showed that if I carried out these operations, I would get essentially the same equations as Sam had got, albeit for an Ising system that I looked at first, an Ising system, just because I wanted to follow the same thing that Sam ordinarily would have done, I suspect, if he had a slightly longer journey and recognized that the simplest things would be Ising spins. But so I got all the equations, and for a little while I was thinking, well, that's fine, it's no big deal then. But it was Scott, when I saw him, that said, well, let's actually calculate what those things give and let's draw some pictures and so on. And that was important in propagating it. But the other thing was the fact that we serendipitously chose Ising spins. I chose them because I thought they were simpler. But by choosing Ising spins, we were able to recognize that there was, even though many of the things look right, there was a serious problem, namely that the entropy was negative at t equals zero, which cannot occur for discrete spins. And we'd done it for continuous spins, vector spins, as Sam did. We'd have got negative entropy again, but we wouldn't have been worried because that's a standard pathology and nobody would have cared. So I think that was somewhat serendipitous, but it was important. And I suspect that this is one of the things that drew the attention of some of the other people who went on, like Almeida and Thouless, Parisi, and so on.
Before we move on, I'd like to talk a bit more about the genesis of that work, right? So as you said, you started this work while you were at Imperial, a bit on your own, and then serendipitously as well, you had organized a sabbatical at IBM to collaborate with Stefan von Molnar.
Yes, I can't remember now quite what the time frames were, but it was about time to go for that. Stefan came to visit me, Brian Coles, and interested me in a problem that he had. And maybe it was during that year that we talked about going, that I would quite like to go to see Scott. And Scott had visited. I knew him, and I knew that he was a good computer guy, and it seemed to me absolutely clear that you had to do some computer simulations on this problem, but I couldn't do it myself. Well, maybe I could, but I wouldn't have done. And so I think it must have been during that year that I arranged with Stefan that I'd go to IBM. I don't remember precisely how much in advance it was, but since I think he was just visiting me for that year before I went, it must have been during that period. When you say you mentioned the idea that, and I was looking forward to a sabbatical, but in fact Imperial had no sabbaticals. There was no sabbatical allowance, but they would let me go, as is go, if we could get paid by somebody else. And so it may have been the fact that Stefan was able to offer me the financial support to go that was able to then persuade the physics department that I could do it. But he only provided 6 months, so I arranged with the ILL for the remaining part.
Yes, so we'll get to that. But again, so you said you knew Scott Kirkpatrick already because he had visited you. So could you tell us a bit more the circumstances, or how did you get to know him and his work?
I can't actually remember. I mean, he was doing things that were sort of interesting, and so I read things in the literature. He came over at some point and gave us a talk, and we went to lunch and all that kind of thing. But I don't remember precisely how it came, but I felt I knew him well enough. And it may have been that he, again, many of these things, this progress has depended on chance encounters, which could or could not have happened. But when they did, they framed a link, and that link was conducting enough for something to come through from it. You know, for example, sometime further on, I went to Schlumberger Doll for a short period. And while I was there, Nicolas Soulas also visited. I had a flat, an apartment already, and waiting for my wife and kids to come during the summer. He didn't have anywhere, so we joined one another, and we got to know one another very well, and we were in the same group. And then that spread out further on and so on. But, you know, this is how things happen. It must happen to you, everybody, I think, these kinds of interactions. I don't remember it precisely. I mean, I can remember some particular instance when I think I was with Scott and a certain story was told, but it's not relevant to this one, so I won't give it here.
Okay. So you showed up at IBM, and you had already worked through a lot of the SK properties. Is that correct?
Yes. I pretty much got all the equations. Yes. I didn't actually calculate the entropy, but I got to the self-consistence equations that you'd have to solve.
So what was left? So what did you do with Scott, or what was Scott's contribution to that?
First of all, he persuaded me that it was interesting and worth publishing. Secondly, when we did this, plotting the various things, they showed interesting behavior, which seemed to agree with some parts of what was known experimentally. There was some which was a little bit different. And then, of course, we stumbled on this this entropy at T equals zero. But I guess that we had the equations for it and just decided, well, let's see what is at the limits of T equals zero, and T equals infinity, of course, was very easy. But so Scott was important. Of course, then other things came came from it as bonuses, you know, like when we're trying to do the simulations and stuff like this. Scott found it was very difficult to get the thing to go down to equilibrate. And I mean, Scott did all the computing. And we then got gradually got to realize that there must be lots of metastable states, for want of better words. And you've got to do something to get out of those things. And I think I remember one conversation when the idea came up, well, why don't we just give it a kick of energy somewhere and get it over the hill? And I think that later must have stimulated Scott to his annealing thing. But I think we, you know, I don't regret the fact that I didn't publish it alone beforehand, because, well, I mean, maybe I do in one respect, but I think Scott certainly deserved to be there. And then the second paper that we wrote, at one point, I mean, he was going to write another SK, and I said, no, let's put this back in alphabetical order, and you go first. It was good, and you know, it's obviously. Scott was already, you know, getting interested in various computer science things and so on. And so, I mean, some of the ideas like graph partitioning and so on were already sort of bubbling up and things. One regret which I had when I was in Steve's group, though, was this was a magnetic semiconductor group. Previously, all the spin glasses people had looked at were metals, but there was nothing I could see in the... what was needed for it that had to be metallic. It just had to be frustrated, and I knew that some of these chalcogenides, that's magnetic semiconductors, some of them were ferromagnetic, some were antiferromagnetic. Typically there was the nearest neighbors were antiferromagnetic, but the next nearest neighbor could be either, and it seemed to me therefore that you ought to be able to make an alloy of these things. And some others were not. So samarium sulfide, europium sulfide are two magnetic ones, but strontium you add some non-magnetic. So I felt that there must be some possibility to make some insulating spin glasses. And I was in the group that worked on these things where there was somebody who could have made those materials. I couldn't persuade him to do it. But I don't know whether he had the facilities to do all the measurements I would want, but I didn't do it anyway. That first came from Germany, but it was a little peeving in a way.
So can you tell us a bit about the immediate reception that your paper with Scott had? Like, and how, you know, did the news spread? As you mentioned, this is pre-archive, this is pre-email.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm afraid I don't remember exactly what happened. I mean, it did seem to grow really quickly, but I cannot remember the mechanisms. The one thing I do remember about an effect that the paper had was that was actually at the APS. And that's because Scott had IBM was developing a new scientific typesetting system, and he used this to typeset the paper. And I think that the thing that the people at PhysRev Letters were most intrigued by was the typesetting. There was a battle going on that time between Bell and IBM, and he was using this other one. But then after we published it, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I went away somewhere else then. Certainly the paper had got some effects, because I think there was a... I talked to... While I was at IBM, I went and visited... Phil Anderson and talked to him about it, and so he knew about it. I gave a talk at an APS conference, so people would have known then, or some of them. And I understand, I've heard that David Thewlis was one of our referees, and that he objected to our original title, which was Exactly Solvable Model of Spin Glasses. He said it can't be exactly solvable because it's wrong. But of course, it's the solution that wasn't exact. The model itself, I think, was so. He accepted soluble. We wouldn't accept exactly soluble. But anyway, there was an Aspen meeting that summer of 1976. where Phil Anderson and David Soulis and your colleague Richard Palmer were all together, and they came up with this TIP thing, which was another important paper. I wasn't at that, probably because I was in France, and I didn't want to add extra perturbations on top of things.
So I
don't know the answer. I mean, Giorgio Parisi only came in somewhat later. You know, Almeida and Soulis were looking at the fluctuations in replica space. So was Brian Moore, and who came up with some ideas about replica symmetry breaking. Pitter and Rudnick and a couple of other people were realizing those things. So Pitter was also at IBM, so I may well have told him earlier on, but by the time that paper came out, I was gone.
So you mentioned...
I don't know, I can't really speak for other people. Go on.
So I was going to move to next. Because you've mentioned a couple of times you actually went to the ILL, to the Institut Lo Langevin, after your time at IBM. But why?
Why? That's a good question. I mean, I fancied going somewhere else, and I quite enjoy France. And there was an opportunity there. I did know a reasonable amount of neutron scattering because it's a neutron facility, because of my earlier contacts with here in England at the at Harwell. You know, I think I mentioned in one of my notes that during the summers of my PhD, I used to come down here to Oxford and join the group of John Hubbard. But also there was a big neutron scattering group there too. So I knew those things. So there was some natural connections there. I have a feeling I'd already been to Grenoble, but I've now, forgotten the details. And the opportunity came, they would pay for me. I could take a year off, and I told you if I was going to go away, I had to get paid. And then I did go back a second time, but that's because during the first time, or towards the end of the first time, I must have been getting on very well with the director. And he asked me if I would come back for a few years. Not permanently, but Philippe Nozière was at that time the head of the theoretical group at the ILL. Philippe was away during the time when I was there the first time. I actually lived in his house, but then he was supposed to be away on leave in America. But then he moved to Paris. He moved to the Collège de France, and they thought that would be, he'd be away. So they invited me back essentially to head of that group. In practice, Philippe kept his house in Grenoble, and he used to come back regularly, and he would continue being the boss. But I had a couple of years there. But I knew about neutron scattering, and I was quite fancy. But there were some good people also in the interested in some of these magnetic things and metallic stuff, alloys in the CNRS and also in the CER. Which are right beside the ILL. They're two, one's the French national thing and the other the atomic energy one. I mean, among the people in the atomic energy place was Jacques Villain, for example, who I didn't know Jacques beforehand, but, got to know him, and there was relevant things there.
So just to make sure I understood correctly, the appointment at Grenoble was never meant to be permanent, or was never, no. You were always supposed to return to here.
My wife wouldn't have killed me. She nearly did anyway, not for going the first time, but by accepting to go back for another couple of years. I had to find a really nice place to live to persuade her. But our kids did learn French.
Yeah. Okay, so one second, please. Can you take him away? So my son is interfering
okay.
with the recording of this interview. Salut, bon gars. Okay.
We can break for a minute if you need to go and...
No, it's okay. He should not have been able to storm in. That's a different story.
Okay.
You mentioned in passing already the work by Thales, Anderson, and Palmer in stealing the gold Anderson recalls Scott Kirkpatrick and you visiting him, visiting his group, and yeah, so to have made him realize that simple thermal annealing was doomed to fail, right? That's his words. How much did you get to know these efforts and Palmer and that work at the time it was being written? How aware were you?
I can't quite remember. I think I got to know of it pretty quickly. I think that they sent the things to me. This was after I'd already left IBM. The visits to Phil that he's talking about were while I was at IBM, and I went and stayed with Phil in his flat, for example, in Princeton. But I can't remember all the details of what we talked about. I also, at that time, of course, came in contact with what became soft matter from Exxon. That was a separate visit, but that was my initial experience of what you call sludge physics, I think, at that time. But that's a separate issue. I can't remember precisely how quickly, but things moved around reasonably quick. The post worked. I mean, we may not have had the internet so equipped so well, but we were in contact. But I worked on different things when I was at ILL.
Okay. So the next first gathering maybe on the theme of spin glasses is the Ossois conference on glasses and spin glasses.
Well,
how important was this meeting? And
I don't remember that it was so that particular one was so important. The ones in Heidelberg were very important. It was useful for making contacts and stuff like that. As I keep telling you, my memory is poor. My principal memory of that meeting has got nothing to do with spin glasses. It was when a German speaker got up and apologized for speaking in English. Started speaking in English, sorry, that's right. And Duchesne said, "You're in France, you should be speaking French." And I think he said he didn't speak French. But then a few moments later, André Blandin got up to give a talk, and he gave it in German, looking directly at Pierre-Gilles Duchesne. That's my strongest memory about that particular meeting. But anyway, that's probably not for the records. There were various people that I met at that time, and it was a good occasion for me to make extra contacts with Benoit Chakraverty, for example, from the CNRS. But the two Heidelberg meetings were much more ones where everybody who seemed to matter was there. In terms of what they did with respect to transmitting ideas from one place to another, I don't remember all of them, but they were very useful for bringing us together as a group.
And speaking of that, the following year there was a Les Ouches school on ill condensed matter.
Yes.
Right, that you participated in.
I only participated very briefly. I gave a seminar, I think. I think Scott gave a lecture. There was that, you know, so it was obviously important. It's one that, I mean, I wouldn't have minded being there for the whole thing, but I don't think I was invited.
Okay.
I don't remember very well.
Okay.
I mean, but anyway, the thing that what I talked about there was something slightly different. I do not remember that, I think, because I was concerned about spin waves in spin glasses. And I found them difficult to work out, and I never completely convinced by Halperin and Saslow. But I then tried to look at some other cases where you might have some analogies. So the difficulty with spin glasses is knowing what the ground state is my difficulty was not knowing what the ground state is to then look at the perturbations away from it for spin waves. On the other hand, however, there is a problem. I sort of invented a problem where you take a Mattis spin glass. Now, if you do that for an Ising system, it's fine. But if you now say that the spins are actually vectors, that can move through Heisenberg ones, then you've got a question about the excitations. you solve the Ising system for thermodynamics by applying a gauge transformation, which changes SZ to minus SZ and cancels the other thing. On the other hand, that screws up what do you even call them now? The SXSY equals SZ. I've even forgotten the words for this, you know, square brackets. Close the brackets equals SZ. You get an extra sign in there. Commutation relation.
Yes.
Screws up the commutation relation, which tells you that there's something different about the excitations. And that's what I wanted to talk about. So I called it, something like special excitations on a complex excitations on a flat background or something like that. I don't remember exactly, but that was a problem which I went on to puzzle with. But it was just part of my thinking process about the excitations. I didn't talk about other things.
So how closely did you follow the theoretical steps that took place between 1975 and 1979, say? Were you part of discussions? Was these discussed in meetings, or were you circulated preprints?
I was aware. I can't completely remember, to be honest. I was at those sorts of times thinking about extensions to systems with anisostropies or other stuff. When the things were coming about replica symmetry breaking, it wasn't really until Parisi came on the scene that I started to take some serious note. Well, I mean, I knew about Almeida and Thouless, but what could I do about it? Brehm Moore, the same sorts of things. I don't think I had any brilliant ideas at that point. Once Parisi did do his things, then I could see that there were interesting things to do. And I went through a number of papers where I've looked at other models where you have more complicated aspects of the Parisi behavior and other aspects with respect to whether you have replica symmetry or an Almeida-Thouless line or a Gabay-Toulouse, in vector system, you have a Gabay-Toulouse line, you know, which is fairly straightforward to think about. It's just the freezing, spin glass freezing in the transverse direction. But then they also wanted to talk about some Almeida-Thouless type of transition by just looking at the longitudinal terms. But there are couplings between the transverse and the longitudinal ones. It makes that a crossover and so on. So I worried about these sorts of things, just depending on what I could do, you know, at the time. But I wasn't tied especially to the spin glass problem. I was just intrigued by the other things it led to, like, you know, going on later to things like hard optimization in other contexts, to graph partitioning, to neural networks, to all this sort of stuff.
Sure. We will get to that. I wanted to just, you know, the series of models you mentioned. What I was trying to understand while looking at the papers is, what was your ultimate motivation? Was it mainly statistical mechanics driven, or was it mainly materials driven? Or I mean, looking at the pot spin glasses, the quadrupolar glass, the anisotropic spin glasses, what were you trying to probe? What was the overarching program?
One of them, for example, looking at Potts glasses, was that I was the ordinary spin glasses were complicated, curious things. But then they also have a special feature of symmetry. In the Ising spin, if you have an interaction which is ferromagnetic, they both want to point the same direction. Anti-ferromagnetic, they want to point in opposite direction. They're both definite statements as a symmetry of definiteness. On the other hand, if you've got a Potts model, you've got one ferromagnetic means they're both the same, whether they're that or that. But if it's an anti-ferromagnet, it can be this, it can be that, it can be any other one than that. So there's no balance. There's no longer any symmetry. You don't have a symmetry of definite. It's either do this or don't do this, as opposed to do this and do that. And I thought, yeah, that must surely do something. And so that's what drove me to look at the Potts model. And then when we looked at that, we discovered, first of all, that there were various different things happened as a function of the Potts dimension, particularly with the Parisi function term. And it was leading to something special when you got to Potts dimension 4, which was then when Sompolinski and whoever it was with now, I've forgotten now, did their Grosser. But even before that, we found unusual things. So partly with these things, I was asking, are there other things that occur? So that one was just based on purely philosophizing. For the other things which were like the anisotropy and so on, I knew that there were materials which were anisotropic and so on. And so it was largely driven by, you know, what other things are there that my experimental colleagues can look for? Similarly, then when it comes to a vector spin glass, and there's a difference between the sharp transition at the Almeida the Gabay-Toulouse transition and a more rounded one at some other thing. These are things that the experimentalists could look at. But I'm often driven by asking, what if it's different from whatever we normally got? Is it important? Sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. There are things which I didn't notice at the time, but which, you know, perhaps should have been ready for, having thought about looking at early on with things that could be either spin glass or ferromagnet. Then it's not so far to go to the problems of neural networks, where you have some spin glass states, but you also have a lot of different quasi ferromagnets, which are the different memories that the thing will settle in. And so it's no great surprise to me that you could have that. The interesting thing from the point of view of memories is how many can you have before you can't store them. But the interest from spin glasses is slightly different. Sometimes I'm driven by experimental observations. Sometimes I'm just by thinking about them. Sometimes the one can lead to the other. But I'm a bit of a butterfly.
It's perfectly fine. It makes for a great career. So I want to get to neural networks, but first I wanted to ask about the work that you did at Schlumberger, actually, that you started the collaboration with Nicolas Sourlas.
Yes.
And that's a leave that you took in 1985. And that's when you started working on graph bipartitioning. So can you tell us a bit how you came to that research direction and to the realization that it's actually related to spin glasses? You mentioned the work of Fu and Anderson. Was that the motivation, or was there something else you had figured out?
Well, it was a motivation partly in the sense that we'd already thought of the things that Fu and Anderson did, but we hadn't published anything, so we had to do something different. I think Scott and I already knew about that, because basically it's just an infinite range system with scaling in the way it. In the extensive system, it's just basically SK model with slightly different ways to get the distribution. But in the SK model, all that matters for the distribution is the first moment, the second moment. Any other things don't matter. I think it's probably talking to Nicola that came up with this, but we just thought, well, you know, what happens if it's dilute? I suppose we perhaps also had in our mind the work of Viana and Bray, who had looked at some diluted spin glasses too, where they were random networks, but with Erdős-Rényi networks with an average but finite number of connections per spin. But we were thinking more in terms of ones where the I guess we could have done that, but then we were probably conscious, I don't remember for certain now, that if you just check into each possible connection only probabilistically, there will be some instances of things which are disconnected completely. Small probability, but there'll be some. On the other hand, if you take it that every single one is connected to a certain number of other ones, but that number is not extensive, it's finite, then you've got another rather interesting problem. And as you know, there's been a lot of work later on these random graphs, they call them. And we felt that the Fu Anderson situation was bound to be similar to the SK model. This other one wasn't clear whether it would be or wouldn't be. We couldn't solve it analytically. So we looked at various things simulationally and found features which you find in spin glasses. And some of those things came from Nicolas's experience in particle physics beforehand, like using Dalitz plots, for example.
I see. This brings up a question about we've touched already a couple of times on this topic, but the relationship between your work and computational efforts, right? Obviously, there was the collaboration with Scott Kirkpatrick, but in 1979, Physics Bulletin, a short op-ed in a sense you wrote, you wrote that computer simulations were instrumental in showing what going on in disordered systems. What other simulations, other than Kirkpatrick's, were you following at the time? And were you ever personally involved in those simulations? Or if yes, to what extent?
The only simulations that I think I was directly involved with were with Peter Young and a guy called Olive, which were on vector spin glasses. And they still get referred to. But that was the first thing, to try and see whether you got some of the spin glass features there. I was earlier also intrigued by the simulations of looking at field-cooled and zero-field-cooled susceptibilities, which showed one of the other features which is characteristic of spin glasses. You know, it's like the one between when you're looking at this. So if you look at the susceptibility, as you know, is it doesn't matter which way you measure it. If it's higher than TC, but beneath TC, you get different things depending upon whether you cool first or put the field on first. There were some nice experiments of these things, which were done by the Germans, I think Kinzel and Binder and people like this. But they helped to build up the picture, what was going on. They were done on shorter range problems, on more like they were done on the Edwards Anderson model, but people these days always largely refer to the Edwards Anderson as the Ising, what would be the Ising version of the Edwards Anderson. I think that our paper with Kirkpatrick was the first one to use Ising things. And now, I mean, I think there's no doubt that that's the simplest one to look at. So when I now talk about EA, I'm thinking of the Ising version of EA is what they did. There were those ones. And I just wondered, there were some things where at that time, many of them were just looking to see, do they reproduce the experimental results? That was the most important thing at the beginning. The experiments were done on systems which had sight disorder and interactions which are frustrated to the function of distance. The theory has almost exclusively been done on problems which have exchange disorder following Edwards and Anderson. It seemed to me important in trying to access whether that's a sensible thing to do the experiments, computer experiments in this case, on the exchange disorder ones. And so I think those were very important in trying to show it was the same physics. Whereas my attempt to do with SK on EA, that wasn't the same sort of thing. That was concerned with the solutions once you've got the exchanges on. So I think they were very important. A lot of people have been doing simulations and some theories on whether there is a critical dimension and all this sort of stuff. And I haven't been so active in that myself, or even say so interested. I mean, I think it's a reasonable question, but I can't understand how some people have spent, you know, decades doing that. I mean, I'd have got bored and gone on to something else.
Speaking of something else, you did around 1988 start to work on neural networks as well, and you said, I mean, in the notes you sent us, you wrote that ultimately Hopfield was the motivation for this, but there's a long path between Hopfield and your work. So what more immediately was driving this new direction for you at that point?
The part of Hopfield that I'm thinking of is his introducing of a model where you had a Hamiltonian J, I, J, S, I, S, J, where S is a plus or minus one corresponding to a neuron firing or not firing, and the J, I, J's are given by the Hebbian formula, which is directly like SK, isn't it? I mean, like Edwards Anderson or whatever. It was just that they were looking at different solutions. So so that's, I mean, I didn't do a lot on that, but what I mentioned to you earlier is that it seemed to me fairly reasonable that it's a kind of extension of the, let me call it the SK, but it's the, or Sheringham-Sutton, where you add something other than the fluctuations, you also add some means. In this, the analog of the mean is more complicated in that it's all these different storage things. So that's one thing. There was the important pieces of work like by DeRida and Gardner in seeing an optimization problem, the way you can try to calculate what is the maximum number of patterns you can store, and then to extend it also as the maximum number of patterns you can store with a certain error, up to a certain error, and so on. So it provided a lot of interesting problems of that kind. Then I didn't do so much on his model. I mean, there are things I've just described. But at Imperial, there was also a group in electrical engineering that were interested in neural networks, artificial neural networks in this case, which were Boolean networks, where the information was stored in Boolean functions rather than in synapses. And so Wong and I started to play and get interested in those. So we did a number of things on neural networks which were complementary to the ones that were done by Hopfield and company, but conceptually, as I say, the model is very similar. Okay. I mean, there's also, then we went on to, at various stages of looking at analogies between neural networks and spin glasses, in the sense that neural networks, I think of as systems where there are neurons and synapses. The simplest model, there are neurons and synapses. They both can, in practice, be changed. Hopfield gave a formula for you for giving the J's based on Hebb's ideas, and the way they're connected is quasi-physical. But if you think about any kind of real sort of, a bit more real, shall I say, artificial neural network like that, you'd have a system where there are neurons which react to the synapses as they are. They react very quickly. They have a fast dynamics. Synapses in the spin glasses are fixed. Maybe it's random, but they're fixed. In a neural system, they're not fixed. They can be changed, but they change on a much slower scale, time scale. So that you have a system, for me, my picture of a kind of quasi-model brain has neurons which have some sort of fast dynamics, synapses which have some slow dynamics. The neurons respond largely when you're trying to remember, to recall something. They respond quickly to whatever the synapses happen to be at that time. On the other hand, if you've got to learn, then you expose yourself to some images for some time. I keep looking at the picture of you. It fires various neurons because it's an applied field, basically. Your different parts are some kind of applied field having an effect on my neurons. That polarization of those neurons then feeds back on the slow dynamics of the synapses, and they gradually build up some pits. And so we learn that way. That's my picture of, I've never seen anybody actually carry that all the way through, but that's my picture, is that the fast neurons, slow synapses. Also, that if you want to make it a little bit closer to the replica type of to replica theory, I suppose, then you can also say that there are noise in these two lots of dynamics. The noise is analog. You can think of an analog of temperature, and so there are different temperatures for the neurons and for the synapses. And that the ratio of those two temperatures plays a role rather like N in the replica theory, and n goes to zero is what corresponds to a situation where the synaptic temperature is very high, so it doesn't give a bugger what the neurons are doing. It's just random, but they still have to react quickly. So it seems to me there are ties between these things, but I don't think there has been quite a few studies, although I haven't followed all of them, on the dynamics of spin glasses and neural networks. But almost completely, as far as I'm aware, in terms of the fast variables, the neurons or the spins. Whereas I think that there should be some study also of the dynamics of the synapses, which will be slower and presenting various patterns to it. I don't know whether anyone's ever done it, but it's always what I thought of and what I talk about in sometimes in seminars, but I don't actually do it.
So speaking of that, actually, so after the postdoc who worked with you on this, Wang, left, it seems that you've also left the field of neural networks study. Is that fair? And if yes, why?
I've left the field of neural networks, yes. I mean, I did quite a bit of things and interacted with a lot of people during that time. I decided I'd been doing it for long enough. I was getting loads and loads of graduate students applying to me to do it, and I was getting sick of it, and I wanted to do something else. So I told them, I'm sorry, I'm not doing any more neural networks. But Wang kept on doing some of these things, and they drove it on further to, you know, traffic flows and communication systems and the Lord knows what. But the other thing was that in neural network stuff, it was getting to the stage where many of the people who were working on it were wanting to become more and more biologically relevant. They were all moving further over towards real neural stuff, you know, people like Sompolinsky and so on. And I am a physicist. I told you I'm a physicist. I think like a physicist. I didn't want to be a biologist. I love to take the biological problem. I'm one of those arrogant physicists who thinks they know how it goes, but only so far.
So thank you. So at about the same time, actually, some American physicists, Kirkpatrick, Thermalay, and Wallace, took upon your ideas of pot spin glasses and developed RFOT as a theory of glass formation. How aware were you of that work? Did you follow? Were you involved?
I was aware of it, and I'm not sure I didn't hear Wallace first talking about it at Aspen or something. But he was basing it on the pots things, and I didn't suggested the pots one, so I knew that kind of thing. I knew that the POTS ones can also have some first order, the discontinuous transitions. I knew about them, but I didn't do a lot about it. But related to it also it reminds me anyway, the other thing that Volnus was interested in protein folding. And I spent a year as the Ulam scholar in Los Alamos, actually in 1995, which is run by when the head of CNLS was Hans Fraunfelder, who was also very famous for proton folding. So I was aware of those things, and through him I was aware of Peter Volinez too. So I was aware of it, but I didn't pursue it a lot myself. It seemed to me to be a sensible approach, and I did have a kind of wish later to see if I could work out how to combine or bring together in their thinking some of the different models of glasses and of things slowing down. You know, there's all the work later, which I was also involved with, of constrained dynamics and what that can do. You know, if it's a case where it's not that the thermodynamics, if you're allowed to try all states, would have a phase transition, but the dynamics prevents them from getting to them and so on. All these things, I think, are connected. And I know it's something that I worked with Juan Garahan about, but never gone to the end, you know. So there have been a number of things which I've thought about for a while, but I've never, you know, really got them to the end.
So on the dynamical scene, you were told to, I'm told you were an early proponent of the work of Jorge Kirchan and Leticia Colliandolo on the dynamics. So how did you hear about that work, and why did you think it was important at the time or since, right?
Well, I mean, they were doing nice things with my model was one thing, my Morrison model. I knew they were both very bright. I knew that Jorge Kuchan was, you know, one of the brightest people that they'd had for a number of years in Argentina. I knew that directly from Argentina and also from his postdoc advisor, Eitan Damani. And I knew about Leticia's work with Daniel Amit and others on the spin on the neural network types of things. But it looked to be there were some very nice ideas there. And I found them, shall I say, appealing in a, I was going to say, like, kind of pretty, whatever the word is, you know, the elegance. I liked the ideas, basically, yeah. And I had them come to visit me, and I was greatly impressed by them. And so I supported them.
So from 1989 on, you became the head of theoretical physics at Oxford, which you've hinted, you know, lowered your availability for your research because of the extra service load you've taken. But it also gave you a bit more power as well, right? Mm-hmm. Have you ever been able to leverage that power to tilt its scale in favor of the study of disordered systems? And, you know, generally as it was.
I didn't actually try to do that. I did what I could to build up what I thought were some of the best people in the world that we could engage in whatever field. I didn't try to build my own empire. I did the obvious thing like getting some decent computers in and encouraging people and so on. But you'll have seen that a lot of my papers are written alone. I've tended not to, build large groups and large collaborations. I think that the people that I've been instrumental in engaging in Oxford are very good and have done very well, but they weren't necessarily my own things. I did interact with some other people outside, so like with some of the people in experimental psychology and other aspects of the biological sciences and so on. And there's some complexity group in our kind of business center. And, we've got people like Don Farmer now, but that was later. So, I didn't necessarily feel that I had to persuade people in Oxford. I mean, I got some good students and some good postdocs, but I didn't try and build up a large group of faculty members in my image. I didn't think it was fair.
Absolutely. So we were just talking about collaborations. It's true that you did not develop a lot of authorship collaborations, but you did participate in a number of international collaborations that were structuring the field. And leveraging in a sense the resources of the European community to do so. So
yeah, I guess my power, I did use the power that way, yeah.
So could you tell us a bit how the community, the statistical mechanics, say, or the theoretical physics community was before and after those collaborations, right? What did it change, from the UK standpoint, not necessarily the full continental scale, but
there had been in the early part of the 70s, there was certainly an awareness of good bits of science going on around various places, but it tended to be dominantly in certain groupings. I mean, there were other groupings, but the ones that were involved with, so Imperial had good connections with SACLEC, with Orsay, and to some degree with École Normale, but SACLEC and École Normale had good connections, and there were also good ones with SACLEC, some of those being on the more mathematical field theoretical side, but not completely. We also had good connections with Genoa. Our experimentalists had good ones with Genoa. That didn't continue in this grouping. And of course, the École Normale had very good connections with Rome, with Giorgio Parisi and so on. They were things that had come from being postdocs or whatever, and other bits of chance. So I was a postdoc in of Walter Korn, and so was Gerard Toulouse. We weren't at the same time, but just afterwards. So, you know, similarly, I just followed Maurice Rice, and so we had a contact that way. And Hans Zitas also, I had been involved with him. He was with Walter earlier too. And then there were, on the experimental side, there were people like Philippe Monod, who he and Zazie Monod, his wife, was a theorist, Philippe experimentalist. They were both at UCSD at the same time that I was. And so there were various little links. And so, you know, people knew people in certain places. But so there was a kind of dendritic knowledge of different groups in different places, not necessarily anyone knowing all of the others. And then, but it was becoming clear that, to me anyway, and I think maybe to some of them, that there was something in this, you know, statistical physics of complex systems. I was never particularly strongly taken to critical exponents and to the renormalization group. Could have been, because my PhD had been all in this functional integral stuff that was ideally suited for it all, but I was doing other things. But in any case, getting the exponents dead right and so on didn't appeal to me. I'm more interested that there are transitions or there is something than what they are, precisely what the values are. But anyway, so there was a growing up of different people. And then there were these couple of meetings, I guess probably the old square one, although I think that was a little bit more on the tail end of the Condor problem than the beginning of the more concentrated system, although partly a bit of each. But then the Heidelberg two meetings brought together quite a lot of these different people together in this these meetings, and we had common inclinations for many things, and or common or overlapping or whatever you want to say, and then. So the desires were growing up, but it was also becoming clear that different places had different problems. So we were able to get postdocs, but we couldn't get travel money. The Italians could get travel money, but they couldn't get postdocs, and so on and so on and so on. And the European community, we were getting feelings that, you know, we were European, and we were good together. Never mind all those Americans over there, you know. There was a strength in Europe that we could build on. It was called the European Economic Community at that time. They decided to have this program called Stimulation Action. And we thought, well, you know, this would be good if we could get one of these things, would help to bring us together and fill in the gaps of where we were, make us able to interact more easily. It wasn't a lot of money, but we didn't have to write lots and lots of reports either. So we applied for that, and it went down very well. And got it, and that then supported various conferences. It supported visits from one place to another, brought in some postdocs and other things too. And then we went on. That was successful. We went on some other ones. Occasionally, we had to tweak it a little bit, so not everybody was in the same network. So at one stage, we had a situation where our application failed because we were too big. So what we did was cut it in half. Nobody was allowed to be in both of them. Each of them applied, each of them got funded, and we held joint meetings. So you have to quit the thing. This also helped to bring a feeling of unity. So as Francesco will and you will both know, I mean, you go to any of these European labs, and it doesn't matter where the people come from. It doesn't matter what their nationality is. They're all part of the same team. They're all European, or a lot of them, maybe. But you know, there's something in common. I think that they, quite aside from the science that this has helped to bring together, it's also been extremely useful, in my view, for European science, and Europe, in principle, should do for Europe more generally, of moving away those barriers. So I voted no about going in Brexit, just in case you're wondering. But So I think those were important. And I mean, somebody that you probably know, you know, Lenka Zeborova and Florence Krakla. One of the networks that we had, it was the one where it was called Sphinx, I think, involved the Czechs. and paid for Lenker to go as a graduate student with Mark Mezard. And after that, the rest is history. But, you know, they provided lots of contacts and in common interests and had some good people too. So I think that they were a success. And I think now what you in the States, I have had the impression, and maybe not so much now, but the a lot of the granting, the federal granting, was fashion driven. You know, the subject this year is high temperature superconductivity or whatever it is, and anything else you're not so keen on. Whereas in Europe, there was a greater freedom in what the things were. And that's, but in the States, as I mentioned in one of my notes, I think there've been some differences with some of the private foundations, like the McDonnell Pugh Foundation. They funded the Center for Brain and Behavior or Cognitive Neuroscience, which you would call, in Oxford, to go across to different things. They would fund things that were just starting that other regular agencies wouldn't fund, and to get them going, and then they can take off. Your Simons one is another one of these things that's obviously going on and doing things and doing a great job of complementing the government by, you know, doing things that are not so easy. And then, of course, along came the Santa Fe Institute and people like Phil Anderson, but that was founded in a slightly different way. It's got a different format. I mean, we're quite a theoretical sorts of group. Well, I think largely theoretical conceptual, rather, with some bits of deep theory, but whereas the Santa Fe Institute is a little bit broader and more psychological and social science and things like that. But they both have things to offer. I mean, it doesn't take, well, it seems to me that there are many things that the politicians could learn from us, both about getting together and also about the way to try and think of complex systems and, you know, recognition that, you know, doing the best thing at the moment isn't always the best thing in the long term, and there are balances and goodness knows what. There's all sorts of stuff.
So to get you back to to those networks. So I think the first such network you created was with Giorgio Parisi. Is that right?
There were three of us that set that going. There was Giorgio Parisi, Nicola Soulas, and myself. I was the coordinator, and they helped me put it all together. So we went on to be also the British representative, the French one, and the Italian. But it went further out than that. But there were the three of us, and we continued that later as well. Until we got to the point where we had to split two in half, and I think I was in one and Giorgio was in another. But
how did you first meet Giorgio then? What was did you get to this network?
I think the first time that I actually met him physically was at a meeting in Rome on localization and disorder or something. I don't remember quite what it was called. I certainly remember that there was a photograph taken of four of us, Scott Kirkpatrick, myself, Parisi, and Toulouse, because there was a hypothesis, the PAT hypothesis. So this was the kind of photo. Anyway, I don't know whether I knew Giorgio before that. I knew about his work, but I don't think Giorgio had a great deal. I have no evidence that he had any interest in statistical mechanics until it came to the puzzle about the replica thing. And he was being challenged by somebody new. What can you do? You know, n goes to zero. Can it mean anything? And so on. And I've tried to ask him about some bits of it. But I mean, maybe you know better than I. But it strikes me, for example, that once he'd done one step replica remedy breaking, and it was good, but not quite enough, then he really had to go to a hierarchy, because zero and one are, for me, sort of special numbers in a way that two, three, four, five aren't, and that the only other structure had to go to a whole new kind of structure, and it would have to be hierarchical. But whether Giorgio thought that or not, I have no idea. But anyway, I think he was intrigued by that, and I think that that episode changed an enormous amount, because he's had such a tremendous influence and is now truly a condensed matter physicist. Although if you still look at his citation index, it's his particle physics things that come first. But that's partly because he did himself no favors by publishing his papers in a sequence of small ones, so nobody ever knows which one to reference. But he also did me a disservice by misquoting my paper in every single one of those first papers by having the numbers wrong. And so I lost a lot of citations because other people were then just copying them from Giorgio. But anyway, I think he's an absolutely brilliant guy. And I think that this was the hook that got him in.
So from that first meeting, Francesco.
Take this opportunity. I wanted to ask you to tell us a little bit more about the period that between the publication of your work with Kirkpatrick on the SK model and its solution. So, I mean, it went quite fast, and there were many attempts from other people. So there is this Blandin work and there is Brian Moore. So do you remember a little bit how it developed? I suppose people were kind of rushing to solve temperature phase of
I think not so many. I mean, we published our paper at the end of 75, and Giorgio's first paper, I think, was 78 or 79. So there was, 4 years. But the first things were a few papers arguing that there were these problems of excitations in replica space. There was a paper by Pitter and Rudnick. It was one by, I can't remember all these now. Well, there's obviously Almeida and Thouless, and these were demonstrating that there was a problem. Further demonstrating, it was obviously already it was a problem, but it was more of a problem. It wasn't just a negative thing, it was instability. Then came Bray and Moore looking at these things. These called the excitons replicons, and they tried to go make the first step of doing a replica symmetry breaking, in which what they did was they took the first M of them and then the next N, I think, or N minus M or something. And then they found that this didn't quite do it, but you took the limits, N went to zero and M went to infinity and various things, but it didn't solve the problem. Blandin had something which was a little bit more like Giorgio's idea, but didn't take it quite so far. And then Giorgio acknowledges those things in his papers. But I don't think that there were any other people who were involved in the replicas imagery breaking. There was a certain amount of concern about the inversion of the small n going to zero and large n going to infinity. But mostly it came around to people thinking that wasn't the actual problem. But I don't quite remember exactly what they did. But then Giorgio came out with his things, which were, well, they were magic, weren't they? I mean, but perhaps a more understandable magic than some bits of Edwards and Anderson initially. But I mean, when you think about it, it is an amazing kind of problem. And he found that, I understand that Giorgio found that the mathematicians hadn't got a clue. Say, what do you do when n zero? And they didn't know. But I mean, the difference, of course, between n going to zero and n equals zero. I mean, I mean, there have been earlier problems where you take an n equals zero limit and they work okay. In polymers is one example, and another is in Edwards earlier on, back in the 50s, I think. Came out with a theory for how to deal with impurity scattering in resistivity, and he did it so that the impurities gave a potential, and electrons would just scatter off these impurities. But then the impurities were correlated in some way that gave an effective interaction between them, and you ended up with a diagrammatic representation that looked a little bit like a field theory expansion. But it had no loops. So then you can go to replacing it by a field theory with an extra replica label, but then take the replica label equals zero at the end and it removes all the loops. But that, so I knew about that, but there were these things, but Giorgio's was just manage it. But then you see the phylogenetic tree and so on, and it looks also reasonable. And then, you know, you also think back to, you know, all those minima and things that you might be getting. The idea that you'd have minima within minima within minima and so on is also a moderately acceptable one. And I think probably was in the eyes of the protein folder people. It certainly Hans Fraunfelder had that kind of concept in mind. But exactly how Giorgio went through this, I don't know, but he had to invent his own things. But yeah, it must have been wonderful inventing a whole load of new mathematics. Oh, wonderful.
So from your situation, hey,
sir, just one technical thing. I have to leave my house, so I will stay with you, but I will switch off the video because I'm going to move with. But I'll keep being with you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
So you're in some ways uniquely positioned because of your deep roots or connections to the US and to Europe.
Yes, I feel fortunate in that. Yes.
To try, and maybe you can try to help us understand what was the American reception to ideas of RSB in the first one or two decades, say, or
I have the feeling that they didn't give a damn. I mean, I don't remember that there was a reaction. I think that the whole main part of the Spinglass theory history, I think, has been European, including many of the side things. But then when there were certain people who were drawn into it, like, I'm losing my head. The head of Microsoft in
Jan Lecker.
Not Jan Lecker. I'm thinking of the lady. Jennifer Chase, or whatever she's called. I mean, she was also knew the people in Paris and so on, and she helped to take some of these things, and also her current husband, into the computing types of areas. And then there's people like Rudy Abanker and so on. These all helped us set things going. And then we got, one went into the probability theorists, you know, because this was a new kind of, that they didn't seem to have thought of the idea that you could have a connected system where the connections were randomly chosen in some way. And extensively from a probability distribution that was intensive. It was the same, is that the right word? It was the same everywhere, you know, but the distribution was the thing. And that seemed to open up whole loads of new ideas for them. But then, of course, they wanted a rigor that was completely different from what was available to us. And that's another place where I really feel that I'm a theoretical physicist, not a mathematical physicist. Part of what a theoretical physicist do is guess when you can't answer the questions, or try something, or go a little bit away from reality and eventually come back. For a long time we've been going off the energy shell in various problems and stuff, but you know, you can't solve the problem that you want, so you change the problem a little bit, gives you some ideas, then try and go back. With all this sort of stuff. So I think it's good that we all come from different bits of background. People like Talleyrand and Panchenko and have really brought some legitimacy. But also there are then the other more strict statistical mechanics, Pierluigi Contucci and many others, Francesco Gara.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you've also had a pretty extensive relationships with Japan in the 80s already. Is that correct?
Yes. It was really mainly with Nishimori, who came as on sabbatical to Oxford. I don't remember who invited him or whether he invited himself or whatever, but we we got talking. He'd already been doing these the things on these Nishimura line and so on. So we did a few things together, and then I've been and visited him. But I wouldn't have said that any of the things that that we did together were particularly fantastic. Some of the things that he's done himself, we talked for many years about the ideas of quantum annealing before he got to do that, but that it came to nothing. But you know, his initial things on Nishimura line were very important, and then the, you know, these concepts. There are some of the things which grew out gradually, but they seem to me to be absolutely sensible. Like that, if you're trying to get the best results of a signal down a noisy line, then you ought to try to do the retrieval with an algorithm which has a similar level of noise as the noise on the line, and so on, like this. You know, all these things that sort of came out of certain models that came out of these other things, but they're sensible. And a number of these things were found simultaneously or quasi-simultaneously in different fields, of course. But different perspectives can be useful. I mean, the theoretical physicists averaging over the disorder, and the computer scientists looking at worst case things. You know, both interesting problems. But and then you have to ask yourself, which is the better one? To know. It's a bit like the problem at the moment. You know, with COVID, should you be trying to get rid of the disease or keep the economy? You know, you can't win both ways.
So we're getting towards the end. There's a few more questions I wanted to ask you. One of them having to do with students. Yes. You mentioned a few of them along the way, but in general, so how did you, and I've read the story of Paul Goldbart, who says he just showed up to your office and that's how he became your student. But how more generally did you recruit students and postdocs?
Mostly, in most cases, they would have applied to do some research in our group, and then you know, it's the way it goes at the moment that we look at all these different candidates and you know, sieve them down, the ones that we think are the brightest and maybe whose interests are closer to some. I mean, now there is more of a tendency to. It's more for postdocs. There's more of a tendency now to look for people who already worked in the area that you want to work them in. Whereas in my day, if you're going to work with Walter Cohn, it was more a case then of who's been showing that they can do something very good, and now I've got something that I want to do, and it isn't necessarily the same as it had before. I've benefited from that. But anyway, so they mostly applied. Paul, I mean, this is maybe not for publication, but I mean, Paul had done poorly in his exams, but then, you know, he knew Sam Edwards, and he went, didn't he go off the States or something, and they did much better there, and he was recommended as being good. I mean, that this poorer degree got wasn't the right reflection, and he just. Just seemed to be good. I also went by to some degree. I wanted people to be good, but I also wanted to get on with them. So it sort of partly depended on kind of personalities and things too. I don't know about a perfect way.
There's still none. There's still no such perfect way. Trust me.
No. And you.
So. During your time at Imperial and later at Oxford, did you ever get to teach a class about spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking? Or was this always a purely a research topic for you? And if you did, can you give us some details about what you did?
I did give some lectures, but I don't know if I recall giving a lectures actually on a replica symmetry breaking thing per se. I more remember it being in kind of a colloquium or something like this kind of context where it didn't give any real details. I can't remember. Okay. I certainly didn't give a whole course on it. No, I did give a course in Trieste, but in Oxford, I don't know. I can't remember. It would have seemed too specialist for our people.
Even your own students?
Oh, well, I would talk to them about it, but not as a special lecture. And you know, there were a few of my students who worked, they did some replica symmetry breaking things, and we would best get a private tutorial on those things.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us about this epoch or the work around it that we might have overlooked? Or
I know. One thing that I feel has been very important from this stuff is a demonstration that theoretical physics is a valuable topic as a thing of its own. And I include your chemistry and the other things in that. There has been an understanding for some time that you can do experiments, make discoveries in some material and apply the material, or maybe some technique, something superconductivity or whatever. But I think that there are also examples that have come from this, how looking initially at some completely obscure materials, these metallic alloys of Brian Coles and others, and finding a way to think about it, has developed an understanding of a whole load of other conceptual issues that have had application in many, many other places. Many of those things are nothing to do with physics per se, but their solution has a lot to do with the theoretical physicists' thinking processes to try to solve them. And I think that has been a really important example. And even though I said that I don't have a great many of my colleagues working on exactly the same thing, I do have my, at Oxford, I do have them around Europe and some other places too, making these movements, which I think are purely driven by theoretical physics as a real subject in its own right. And I mean, you can include computer experiments are another example of a theoretical type of application in other places. But but in this context, the point is that those experiments that you're doing are not trying, or some of the ones that I'm interested in, are not trying to do an experiment on exactly what the real world is like. They look at their experiments on models, which help you to understand better what the underlying important aspects are. And I think that those two things, both the analytic and these numerical experiments that are done by computer simulations on simple models, has been extremely fruitful and will be extremely fruitful. And so I feel very happy that to do this as a ex-head of theoretical physics, although I did enjoy also the time when I spent with the experimentalists. Now, we must talk to experimentalists, of course, but there is another tool that we've got, a mental tool, and it's applicable.
Do you still have notes, correspondence, papers from that epoch that you've kept? And if yes, do you have plans to deposit them in an academic archive?
A very good question, point. And I think my answer is a little bit like that of John Hopfield, that I don't really think I've got anything that's very very useful. I suppose earlier on, there would have been letters and so on, and I did used to file loads of these things away, but I was never very good at that. And when I've been moved from office to office after my term as head of theoretical physics vanished, I had to clear out huge amounts of stuff in relatively small times, and I think most of it just simply got binned. So I might have a few, but not very systematically. I have a filing cabinet which I think I've kept some of the things about these networks and stuff, but I can't go in my office at the moment. Well, I could, but it's a bit of a fuss. So I'll look at things. Otherwise, not a lot. And you know, I don't keep all the emails, and every now and then my computer craps out and I lose everything or whatever. So I don't think I have a lot that's a great deal of value to you. And some of the things I don't even know. I mean, I got a medal years ago in the French Senate, but I haven't a clue what it was for now, or what it was, but that's a minor point. So I might have a few bits and pieces, but not like the things that the people 100 years ago used to keep, all these goddamn letters and so on. And I never thought that I'd say I was doing would be particularly important. I'm just an ordinary guy from an ordinary place, and that's where it goes. But I think you're doing a great job here, actually, doing this. And you should remind the rest of your young colleagues that perhaps they should keep some of those notes that I haven't kept.
Thank you very much for all your time and your efforts. It's been truly a pleasure to get to know you more and to find out more about the work and these very special times in which you got to work.
Well, thank you too. Thank you both as well. Let me ask you a final question. I was intrigued to see that all your Zoom links are in French. And I do realize that you're a French Canadian, but is it advantageous to go through Quebec or something?
So it's just the default settings on my own computers. They carry over to all the apps. No one complains strongly enough that I should.
I don't mind. They're a sort of French that I can read, it's fine. Anyway, good luck for the rest of this project. And, you'll send me something to look at, won't you?